You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Foz Mamoon, and Seth Miller.
So, Foz, we're sitting here in Taipei at the Grand Hyatt.
We are in a rather lovely room at some time in the evening, 10:20.
10:20. I mean, it's a little late. We've been going all day. I think we walked 10 miles today.
It's a sizable amount of walking.
Yeah. So far, so good.
I still don't believe we walked 6 miles this morning. I feel like we walked around the block.
It was far. So we're here. We were doing a mileage run. This is actually if listeners remember, we had a terrible adventure.
It's terrible. Come on. That's dramatic.
Yeah, well, it was an adventure. We'll say that.
That's fair.
And we had to abandon this trip on our original scheduled itinerary. And so now we're here trying again, and you're headed home tomorrow, as am I. You're taking the nonstop Taipei, San Francisco back. I'm headed to Hong Kong in the morning at the crack of dawn to catch Hong Kong, San Francisco. I think you said earlier you're ready to go home.
I am. Unfortunately, I have 4 more flights before I get home.
Because you have to go down to San Diego.
I do. This.
Yeah. Just when you think you're home, you're not home.
No. So close yet so far.
let's talk about the flight over. We flew San Francisco Taipei on the nonstop in the new United Polaris seat on the 77W.
This is your first time in the seat. What'd you think?
First time in the seat. I'm mixed. I think I was surprisingly optimistic, and the seat's nice. It is tight, in my opinion.
But which of the direct aisle access offerings today is not tight?
Yeah, true. I think it's definitely the price we pay for direct aisle access. And, you know, it was a great seat. I sat in the window, the one that's closer to the window, so the odd-numbered window seats, 17L. I just found that little wall that they have there, plus the where the table is, the tray table, it just makes it hard to roll over or be a side sleeper. And that's how I usually sleep in these seats. On the way back, I'm actually in a bulkhead, and I'm interested to see what that feels like as far as space.
Okay. Yeah, because I've sat in both bulkhead and non-bulkhead, and I mean, they're tight, but I feel you have a lot more leg space on those than you do in, like, the Delta AA763 seats.
Well, and I think what I noticed was it's longer. The bed is definitely longer. My feet on the Delta seat, or even on the pre-merger Continental seat, it touches the end, even if I'm as far back in the seat as I can go. When I lay down, I can touch end of the seat.
But is that a 7.7 difference versus a 7.6 difference? Because the 7.6s are closer.
Yeah, I think it's like the 7.7.
Because on the Delta flight you did was a 7.6.
And that one was, that was also very short.
Yeah.
But I think it's definitely, there's a noticeable length difference. Like, I had to actually try to touch the end of this one.
Well, it'll be interesting to see when we get our chance to be on the 7.6 with the Polaris seat, what it's like.
Yeah, I'm going to look for the plane tomorrow when I go to Haikou in Hong Kong. Or I'm not going to Haikou, but I'll look at F4.
Just get off, you know,
just get a tour. Just get a tour. So, yeah, I thought it was a good flight. Crew was a typical crew. Nothing special about the flight. Nothing amazing to me. Food, I thought, was mediocre. This is something we can talk about. Like, we kind of were talking about how, the meal I had was just not subpar, but meh.
I don't feel they serve full meals anymore. The portions are so small at this point.
Yeah.
That I feel they're really, like, tapas.
Yeah, flavor wasn't very good on mine. The amount that I received wasn't very large. And the salad was all kale.
Well, you're from Portland. That's appropriate.
Well, I mean, it's appropriate. It doesn't mean I had to enjoy it.
Yeah, well, part of the bouquet of kale.
Yeah. That's a shout out to Mr. Brian. But I think what, you know, I was the flavor of the food. I mean, you know, we were kind of talking about this on the train ride into town 2 days ago. Is it even worth it to eat airplane food?
2 days ago?
Yeah.
It was yesterday.
Oh. Yeah. I don't know what day it is.
Clearly.
I'm just drinking my ginger ale, ready to go to bed.
It's been a long day.
But, you know, we were talking about how, is it really worth it to even eat airplane food?
Yeah. It's like the lesser of two evils, right? Because the airport concession situation is getting so bad with the proliferation of things like OTG.
And I would just say just general selection is fairly bad in most airports.
Yeah. Some airports are getting, I think selection is getting better than it was.
Yeah.
Right, I mean, if you think back, what were your options? Some fast food establishment.
Yep.
One of the known fast food establishments. And some other random stuff.
Annie Ann's.
Sometimes. Yeah. But we're getting that back at Newark because apparently there's a market for that.
I like a good pretzel.
Yeah, as do I, but not the greasy crap they call a pretzel.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, I had the, so I'll tell everybody, I had the chicken, the spice chicken curry or whatever they call it. It was way too sweet, needed more spice, and just was, like, to the point where I couldn't really eat it. Like, I just kind of ate half of it, maybe. And it was a smoked duck appetizer. It was, like, three slices of duck bacon. And was meat. I mean, it tasted good, but it was too slight. It wasn't really.
Is that why you needed chicken so badly today to write yesterday?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the duck and the chicken. Yeah, so I just kind of was like disappointed, I guess. And the snack selection was, by the time I napped and went up there to get a snack, they were all gone. All that was left was these wraps that did not look edible.
Well, clearly they were edible at some point.
Yeah, like 4 hours earlier when they were still cold. What'd you have?
I had the stir-fried dish with shrimp and scallops and a ginger sauce. I mean, the flavor was decent. It was just the portion was small.
Yeah.
That was the real problem.
You wanted more of it.
Yeah. Two shrimps, two scallops.
Yeah. Not a whole lot of protein there.
I'm not sure where that's an entree.
Yeah. And then you slept through breakfast.
I did.
Which, again, we landed at 8:10. We were delayed, and we landed at 8:10 at night.
Hey, it was 8 a.m. somewhere.
Yeah. So here's some bacon and eggs and enjoy it. Yeah, I just, you know, I still think especially those arrival times, the Hong Kong and Taipei arrivals, they arrive, I mean, it makes sense on the Singapore flight because it arrives at 6 a.m., but I think at 8:10, even if you've been sleeping the whole flight.
On the Singapore flight, by the time you're arriving, you're delirious.
Well, we're doing it in 2 weeks.
So. I know, and we will be delirious. I've done that once. It ain't fun.
I just want to know how they don't run out of food on that.
Who says they don't?
Well, yeah, well, I guess we'll find out. I did have my ice cream in a paper cup. Did you have the ice cream?
No, I slept through it.
Yeah.
Paper cup.
Yeah. Anyway, it was an interesting flight. I'm interested to see how Hong Kong goes, and I will probably sleep most of that flight, as I'm guessing you will too.
Oh, yeah, I'm hoping. I mean, you have to be up at the crack of dawn, or yeah, well before the crack of dawn.
And I'm flying Cathay for the first time ever.
Wow.
Yeah, so we'll see how that goes. Yeah, we're recording this at 10:30. I need to be up in, like, 7 hours. But what have you thought about Taipei? I mean, we haven't spent a ton of time here, but we did walk around quite a bit. Two failed attempts to go to Din Tai Fung.
Yes. Almost a third until we realized it was 2 miles away.
And they were like, eh, it's not worth it.
No. Because you know you'd have to wait.
Yeah, exactly. We got to the first Din Tai Fung. Wait was 60 minutes. And I could have probably put up with the 60 minutes. We probably should have put up with the 60 minutes. But we couldn't figure out how they were actually queuing everybody up. It was very, like...
There's a line. We just don't know where it was.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then we went to the second Din Tai Fung, and the wait was 80 minutes, and there was a very clear line, but it was a madhouse in that mall.
In malls.
Yeah, and that was the Taipei 101 mall, which I've heard that's like the tourist trap one, but...
Yeah, do you ever wonder how they named that building?
You do. I mean, we know that why, but they couldn't come up with anything else.
The why is because there's 101 floors for the people that don't know.
Yeah.
But, like... Where do you come up? Like, it's like the CN Tower. We'll call it the Canadian National Tower.
Uh-huh.
I just sometimes wonder. These are the things that keep me up on those long flights when I can't sleep.
This is why you stir at night.
Yeah.
Because these are unanswered questions, huh?
Yeah. Speaking of unanswered questions.
Okay.
Have you ever wondered why they call it most airports, but some are, like, we've got the Portland Jetport. Portland, Maine. And is that just aspirational?
Because they never get jets?
If they rarely get jets. I mean, they've only started getting jets recently because of regional jets.
True.
And, like, the Sunport.
And Albuquerque. They want to let you know it's sunny. But I think there's far more appropriate places to call a Sunport.
Yeah.
Phoenix should be called a Sunport.
Exactly. Like, Beijing, I understand why they call it an airport. They're aspirational about air.
Oh, but I'm...
That was too easy.
yeah, I mean, it's a good question. Why these other names? Did they just not want to use the airport name? And why do we call it an airport?
Yeah.
Flying port?
Flyport?
Flyport. I like that. It's catchy.
Catchy. Could also be something that you leave down accidentally.
Mm. Yeah. Happens from time to time.
Yeah.
So these are the questions that really just bug you.
This is what kept me up, but this is what I was thinking on my flight over, and I couldn't say it. And I don't know why it came to mind, but it was an interesting one. I'm like, why an airport, and why a Sunport, and why a Jetport, but why did those two names take off?
Yeah, and are there any other airports that you can think of, or any other locations that have different names?
That's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah. Huh. I mean, like, I look at, like, you know, in Germany, they don't call it an airport, it's a Flughafen.
Yes.
It's a flight haven. I think that's the literal translation. Oh. I don't know.
I did not know
that. Yes, I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah. And when you translate, like, the Jetport or the Sunport? Do they like say Spanish? Is it still Aeropuerto? Or do they?
Do they have to say? I'm trying to remember my Spanish.
I can't remember myself.
Oh, what is Sun? I don't remember. Anyway,
Sol Porto.
I think people would look at you like you're a crazy person.
Exactly.
Sunport. Anyway, some of the other topics we were thinking about as we walked around Taipei and pontificated.
Yes. Armchair CEO.
We were talking about our U.S. carriers, U.S. airline carriers, and the race to the bottom.
And this was really prompted by your comment about 343 seating.
Yeah.
Which was all what we're seeing now is. Now, I think back to, you know, post 2001. As we know, most of the majors filed bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
One of the exceptions was Continental, which we were both very loyal to Continental in the day. But Continental at the time really took a stride to differentiate themselves. And so one of the things they did was they didn't go for the lowest common denominator. They opted for offering a premium product.
Yep.
In many ways. And that served them well. And we what we're seeing now is all the U.S. carriers have forgotten about that aspect and they're just matching everybody else, right? So as an example... this basic economy thing, everyone's just matching the lower carriers because they're so desperate for the low-end business where you could reduce capacity, go for the higher premium traffic, and generate a higher revenue per mile.
And do you think that's completely driven by the airline, or do you think it's driven by the consumers as well, where consumers aren't willing to pay for the premium?
It's driven... That's not. I would argue that that's not necessarily the case because... The people shopping for price are always going to shop for price.
Yeah.
Right? You're generally not flying. Most people are not. There's still a perception thing, right? So people in their minds, if you go to the average person who flies once a year, in their mind, a low-cost carrier is still cheaper than a major.
Mm.
Right?
Regardless.
How many people still flock to Southwest even though Southwest is rarely the cheapest?
Yeah.
Right? It's just been programmed into them. So people are going to think about things like Spirit and stuff. And the way they market, right? There's a very different way.
It's the low fare. It's the bare fare.
Yeah. Because you can't really, you go into Google, you type in bare fare, right?
Spirit comes up.
But you get a very different kind of, the results you get back are very different than if you were to go in and type in basic economy.
Yeah.
Right? Because basic economy, you're going to have a lot of people complaining, whereas bare fare will really be more of a marketing-driven concept.
Yeah, they're owning that marketing.
Yeah.
That's an interesting take.
And it was because historically, pre-merger United did a lot of consolidator fares, which is why they flew such large wide bodies into Asia all over the place at the time. And after the merger, they cut a lot of that down, which is why they were able to reduce so much capacity.
Yeah.
But it looks like the tide's now switching back to going back after any business they can get, which, I mean, anyone who's done business, there's always the bad customer, and you have to ask yourself, is this the right customer base to go after?
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the cases where Delta's differentiating themselves. They are actually offering a slightly more premium product and not lumping themselves in with fighting the low-cost carriers as much as United and American right now.
Mm. And, I mean, do you think American's trying to do the same since they have the basic economy?
I think American is going after it much more aggressively than United.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah.
And... Even on international routes?
I don't think we've seen it on international yet because I don't think they've figured out how to handle that.
Yeah.
Because it's a logistics challenge between baggage and food and things like that on international.
Whereas these low-cost carriers that have already figured it out, like WOW, and trying to think, who was that one that just started? Level. And, Scoot.
Well, remember, these guys all have the advantage of they started from the ground up, right?
Now, imagine, as a low-cost carrier.
As a low-cost carrier. And that's really all they offer.
Yeah.
Right? Everything is a la carte unless you buy certain classes. Whereas with a United and American, they have to go back and modify their entire systems.
Yeah.
Right? And United and American, the majors still have a very large sale through GDSs.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I wonder about is, you look at, an airline like WOW or Scoot, and, their systems are set up to say you can reserve a meal. You can get an extra legroom seat. You can get an extra bag. All these things are recorded through your transaction. And so when you go to the airport, they're there. They're already there for you. Everything's set up. They know you by your seat number, right? And they say, oh, this person gets a meal. This person doesn't get a meal. And everyone knows what to expect. I feel like that's such a shift for the American carriers if they were to go that route.
It is. And then the other wild card you have is elite status. The low-cost carriers don't have elite status. Mm-hmm. So people, I mean, we see it on a regular basis, people with status get treated differently on board than people without status. So you've got two different, you've got it coming from two different angles.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if they were going to go that route, do you think it's not a premium product, right? Going to the a la carte model in economy.
No, what they should really do is just stop using the GDSs and save millions of dollars.
Yeah, and just sell direct.
Yeah.
Do you think that would hurt their bookings, though?
It's reprogramming behavior, right? Yes, would it take a dip in bookings? Absolutely, for some period of time. But once people start doing that, the reality is the GDSs will eventually cave on price if airlines start leaving.
Yeah.
Right. Right now, GDSs have such a stronghold. They charge exorbitant fees.
Yeah. And do you think then, if they took away GDSs, the airlines would have to handle the interline fares and things like that, right?
Yeah. Well, they still have APCO to publish the fares.
So they would still be able to publish multi-fares, multi-airline fares and things that they needed to without...
And they can issue tickets on each other.
Yeah.
Like, that's how they push a ticket. That's how United pushes a ticket to AA or vice versa.
Yeah.
Right? They have the ability to book on each other.
Yeah.
It's just what you're seeing now is, with the airlines, more and more are developing direct connections to other airlines.
Mm-hmm.
So they are slowly eradicating the GDSs for a lot of the interdependency.
Yeah.
But that is probably one of their biggest costs they have.
Hmm.
And so when you think of like American, they need to now code something new in Sabre. That's millions of dollars in project money for Sabre to go do, to sit on and take their sweet all time.
Yeah. Yeah. While they try to get a feature in.
Yeah.
An update.
Exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, you know, we when you talk about custom software versus kind of packaged solutions, you know, the old adage is packaged solutions are almost always cheaper than you writing your own code in the long term.
Yes and no.
If there's no maintenance fee or...
Well, yes and no. But the reality is these things are so complex. Just like SAP, right? Mm-hmm. Such a complex product. Yeah, it's easy to... It's cheap to buy it. The amount of money you spend customizing it to get it to do what you want is exorbitant. And you would be much better off starting from scratch because then you own the entire stack. There's no licensing costs. The vendor can't change the renewal costs, right?
Yep.
And you have a lot more flexibility. It makes you much more agile as an institution.
But, corporations don't want to go that direction. But they love the idea of a package solution, regardless of if it costs them more money.
Yes and no. I mean, there's a shift, right? There people are shifting. And businesses require much more agility now than 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And package solutions do not buy you the agility you need.
I mean, we've heard of airlines asking for API access to different things and wanting endpoints to different systems.
I mean, look at United.
Yeah.
United has by far the most functional website, the most functional app. It's because they control the stack.
Yeah.
Right? Every time when they had to code in the AirOps thing, they just developed it internally. They didn't have to go to Sabre or Amadeus and say, we need this, and go back and forth and spend millions of dollars of finger pointing and delays to get it done. They can just control it. And it's a typical outsourcing challenge is that people developing it actually have a vested interest because they are part of the company versus an external company, which is they're just a customer. They're not, it's not my, doesn't impact me.
It's not us. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so let's go back to the original topic. I mean, your comment today was you think the impact is, or the reason for this shift in the airline industry is because of shareholder bottom line.
Yeah, so that was one of the things we were talking about is, you know, there was something I was reading not that long ago that in the late 70s, early 80s, there was this the massive movement in shareholder return.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what's driven a lot of the behavior from most large corporations because they're more concerned about how can we make the shareholder happy and not really appeal, you know, keep tabs on your customer. Like a great example is appliances, right?
Mm-hmm.
30 years ago, you bought an appliance, it was there for 30, 40 years. Now appliances have an average lifetime of 7 to 10 years. And the reason is they want them to be disposable so you come back and buy another one.
Which is terrible for everybody.
It's
terrible for you as a consumer. It's also terrible for the environment and landfills and just reuse again and again.
But it's all shareholder value.
Yeah.
Right? Because they need – and this is why we see such a large shift in things going from – you buy something to everything subscription-based.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's recurring revenue that they can continue to show investors, oh, look, we have this continuing revenue stream.
Yeah, recurring revenue or die
is
kind of the motto nowadays. That's a good point. I mean, the subscription stuff really kind of gets under my skin sometimes because there's software that I love, like software especially has gone subscription-based. There's software that I love that has moved to subscription models, and I want to use the software, but I want to own the software.
Yeah.
Why am I paying you for the right to use it every year?
Yeah.
I'd rather buy it from you and expect maybe a major one major upgrade before I have to pay you again to get a newish version. I mean, I kind of brought this point up on Twitter. I think like things like Apple, I think like Apple software itself in the last 5 to 6 years has gone downhill so much as far as QA and quality, where it's pushing me to other systems because I can't have a system where you can root in and, you know, it gets published on a forum for a week and no one notices.
Yeah, details.
And, you know, things like that, though. And then, you know, I have to keep up. I mean, no one needs a yearly release of a 1.0, a 1.0 software.
No.
No one. I mean, it's just stupid.
No, 1.0 with the latest iOS, we're at 1.2 and it's still buggy as crap.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think, like, my point with that is I'm thinking about airline systems and airline just comfort. Why not just maybe stay? Why not try to be innovative necessarily, but be consistent? I mean, we've had this discussion before about, say, United. Back during the merger of Continental United, the biggest complaint was there's no consistency. The only consistency is there is no consistency with anything. The product, the food, the staff, everything.
But that was even before the merger, that was United. They were consistently inconsistent.
Yeah. But so now that's translated into Continental.
Yeah.
And I think that's like a deep frustration. And I'm sure people that fly American and US Airways see the same type of thing. I think Delta's done a good job of being fairly consistent. I've been on probably 30 Delta flights in the last 3 years.
But they've had a much longer time, right? When you first, within the first year or two after the merger, like you got on a Northwest plane, you knew you were on a Northwest plane.
Mm. Well, I mean, but look at United today, though.
Yeah.
You don't really know. If you're not an av geek like us, you don't know which kind of plane you're on.
Yep.
But as far as service and general culture and consistency of the product and coach, I'd say it's still kind of all over the place, right?
I think it has less to do with the delineations of which group is working it and more to do with seniority and the base.
Mm. Yeah, like where they're at, where they're located.
Because, I mean, in the last couple of years, I've had some of the most junior flight attendants are some of the best ones out there.
Because they're passionate about their job.
Yeah. They're enjoying it. They're loving it. They're great. And I can't speak enough great words about them. And then you get people who've been on both sides of the fence who've been doing it for 30 years, and they're kind of over it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wonder how we kind of move forward in the airline industry with that kind of mentality. Because, you know, it's not fun to fly a carrier when everyone's just pissed off. The staff is pissed off. The gate agents are pissed off. It's just not fun. But if you're going to talk about quality, a high-quality carrier, you have to be consistently on your game across the board.
Yeah.
And is that a product now of being so stretched so thin with routes and trying to be, you know, build a route network and have connections to everywhere and flight schedules that are really unmaintainable or unattainable to begin with?
No, I think it has more to do with corporate culture and not permeating everywhere.
Mm.
I mean, we talked about this in our last trip in vain. Like, San Francisco is one of the worst airports to deal with for United, unless you're Global Services.
Because they just get treated like...
Yeah, everyone's dirt.
Yeah.
And clearly, the airline hasn't... I mean, until they address the leadership problem there to push that all the way down, it's not going to get better.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my example is I had a flight from Las Vegas to San Francisco to Portland, and I got on an earlier flight in Las Vegas, and they protected me because there were some delays going on. And the guy told me in Las Vegas, he said, just tell them, if you make the earlier flight, just tell them to release the next flight, and it'll be fine. They'll just knock it off your reservation and open up the seat for the next person. And I said, okay. So I go up to the gate agent, and I tell her this, and she just looks at me like I'm insane. And I'm like, well, I'm trying to help you out because you guys are going to have to open that seat up later anyway.
Yeah.
Like, why not just let me do it now? And I can see this gate here. I'm going to make this flight.
Yeah.
And she's just like, fine. Like, rolls her eyes at me. And I just didn't even know what to think. Like, it just, you know, basic stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know where I was going with that. But I think, like, the product, going 343 in the back, I looked back there. I mean, I was seated in the back of the business class cabin. And I looked back. It just looked miserable. There were a lot of empty seats, so those folks were lucky because some of them could lay down and have a lie flat Y, but some folks were pretty packed in there.
But I mean, I guess that is a really interesting question of how much of the 343s are running at 95% load factor.
Mm. My Hong Kong tomorrow it's probably almost close to 100% in the back.
But is that an outlier?
I don't think so. I think Hong Kong is consistently full. It was consistently full on the 74s.
Well, I mean, from a 343 perspective, on the grander scale, is it an outlier?
Yeah, it might be. Might be.
And that's the real question.
Yeah. And is the revenue from those extra seats so significant? It's basically there to prove to the shareholders that you've basically lowered your cost a seat mile, right?
Yeah, but like, I mean, we look at what fares are doing. It's like under $400 to go from the East Coast to China.
Yeah, I mean, are they going to be a product of their own demise? Like, they're going to create their own demise.
Yeah, because think about it, right? You're going from Philadelphia to Beijing on United.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go to either Chicago, San Francisco, or Dallas,
mm-hmm.
right? You're paying $400. You're taking a seat away from Dallas, Chicago, or San Francisco. What fraction of that $400 is that domestic portion?
Yeah.
Right, $100?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Can you sell any one of those seats for more than $100?
Yeah.
Domestically. More likely than not, yes.
Yeah. That's a good point. Man, like on Philly Dulles, you're probably selling it for $500.
Yeah, quite possibly. I mean, well, Philly Dulles is all connecting, right? So it really depends on where you're going.
Yeah.
But Philly Chicago business market, you're definitely going to be able to sell it for more than $100. Philly San Francisco, definitely as well. Because there's only two flights a day.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting question because they're basically pricing themselves out. And the argument from the carriers is, well, we've got to match the supply and demand that the Chinese carriers are bringing to the market. Or in the argument of the Middle East carriers, you know, the ME3 that they're.
Yeah, but in the case of the ME3, they all just bailed.
I know. But I'm just saying that's the argument from the U.S. carriers.
Yeah, but it raises an interesting question. Yeah, so like, is this a business you really want?
Mm. To be the low-end carrier.
Like, you know, as the age-old adage goes, if your friend jumped off a bridge, would you?
Yeah, yeah. Lemmings to a slaughter.
Yeah. Because the other problem is when airline demand, travel demand declines, it becomes a much bigger exposure point.
Yeah, now you have a lot more seats that aren't filled.
Yeah. So your cost per filled seat goes up drastically.
Yeah, yeah. Fuel and everything to get the plane off the ground. Yeah, that's a good point. Oh, man. So what have you thought of the Taipei so far?
I like it.
We went to the Shilin night market.
Yeah, and we went to another night market closer to our hotel last night. Shilin was overwhelming.
To say the least.
Yeah.
It was like a swimming pool of people.
Yeah. It was just people everywhere and people who don't want to move.
Yes. Right in the middle of the walkway.
Yeah. I just wanted to run people over.
Oh, man. Well, I think that's the show. Listeners can find us on Twitter at DotsLines, more dots, more lines.com. And we'll talk to you next time. Happy travels. Bye-bye.
See ya.